Chapter 15. You would call us weak? Fear talks out of the side of the mouth. Each item in your list is an attack that turns its stab upon yourself, displaying the bright terrors that floor the potential for wonder. You drone out your argument as if stating naught but what is obvious, and so it is, but not in the way you think. The pathos revealed is your paucity of wisdom disguised as plain speak from your tower of reason. As if muscle alone bespoke strength, as if height measures the girth of will, as if the begotten snips thorns from the rose, as if the hearth fire cannot devour a forest, as if courage flows out lost monthly in wasted streams of dead blood. Who is this to utter such doubt? Priest of a cult false in its division, I was there on the day the mob awoke, storming the temple of quailing half-men. You stood gape-jawed behind them as your teachings were proved wrong. Shrink back from true anger. Flee, if you can, this burgeoning strength. The shape of the rage against your postulated justifications is my soldier's discipline, sure in execution and singular in purpose, setting your head atop the spike. Last day of the man sect, Savelanatha of Genabaris, cited in Treatise on Untenable Philosophies Among Cults, Genorthu Stulk. Many children, early on, acquire a love of places they have never been. Often, such wonder is summarily crushed on the crawl through the sludge of murky, confused adolescence onto the flat, cracked pan of adulthood with its airless vistas ever lurking beyond the horizon. Oh, well, sometimes such gifts of curiosity, delight, and adventure do indeed survive the stationary trek, said victims ending up as artists, scholars, inventors, and other criminals bent on confounding the commonplace and the platitudes of peaceful living. But never mind them for now, since for all their flailing subversions, nothing really ever changes unless in service to convenience. Bainisk was still, in the sheltered core of his being, a child, ungainly with growth, yes, awkward in a body with which he had not yet caught up, but he had yet to surrender his love of the unknown. And so it should be wholly understandable that he and young Harlow should have shared a spark of delight and wonder, the kind that wove tight between them so that not even the occasional snarl could truly sever the binding. In the week following that fateful tear in the trust between them, Harlow had come to believe that he was once more truly alone in the world. Wounds scabbed over and scabs fell away to reveal faint scars that soon faded almost out of existence, and the boy worked on, crawling into fissures, scratching his way along fetid, gritty cracks in the deep rock, choking at times on bad air, stung by blind centipedes and nipped by translucent spiders, bruised by shifting stones, his eyes wide in the darkness as he searched out the glitter of ore on canted close walls. At week's end, however, Bainisk was with him once more, passing him a jug of silty lake water as he backed out of a fissure and sat down on the warm, dry stone of the tunnel floor. And in this brief shared moment, the tear slowly began to heal, re-knitted in the evasiveness of their eyes that would not yet lock onto the reality of their sitting side by side, far beneath the world's surface, two beating hearts that echoed naught but each other. And this was how young boys made amends. Without words, with spare gestures that, in their rarity, acquired all the necessary significance. When Harlow was done drinking, he passed back the jug.
"Fenaz is on me all the time now," Bainisk said. "I tried it with him again, I mean. But it's not the same. We're both too old for what we had once. All he ever talks about is stuff that bores me."
"He just likes hurting people,"
Bainisk nodded. "I think he wants to take over my job. He argued over every order I gave him."
"People like him always want to take over," Harlow said. "And most times when other people see it, they back off and let them. That's what I don't get, Bainisk. It's the scariest thing of all."
That last admission was uncommon between boys. the notion of being frightened. But theirs was not a normal world, and to pretend that there was nothing to fear was not among the few privileges they entertained. Out here, people didn't need reasons to hurt someone. They didn't need reasons for doing anything.
Tell me about the city again, Mole. There's a haunted tower. My uncle took me to see it once. He has big hands, so big that when he holds yours, it's like your hand disappears, and there's nothing in the world could pull you apart. Anyway, there's a ghost in that tower, named Hinter.
Bainisk set on him wide eyes.
Did you see it? Did you see that ghost? No, it was daytime. They're hard to see in daytime.
It's dark enough down here, Bainisk said, looking round, but I ain't never seen a ghost. Harlow thought to tell him then. It had been his reason for bringing up the story in the first place, but he found himself holding back yet again. He wasn't sure why. Maybe it was because the skeleton wasn't a true ghost.
Sometimes, he said, the dead don't go away. I mean, sometimes they die, but the soul doesn't, leave the body. It stays where it is, where it always was.
Was this Hinter like that?
No, he was a real ghost, a spirit with no body.
So what makes ghosts of some people but not others? Harlow shrugged.
Don't know, Bainisk. Maybe spirits with a reason to stay are the ones that become ghosts. Maybe the Lord of Death doesn't want them, or lets them be so they can maybe finish doing what they need to do. Maybe they don't realize they're dead.
He shrugged again.
That's what my uncle said. He didn't know either, and not knowing made him mad. I could tell by the way he held my hand tighter.
He got mad at a ghost?
Could be. That's what I figure anyway. I didn't say nothing to make him mad, so it must have been the ghost. His not knowing what it wanted or something.
Harlow could well recall that moment. Like Bainisk, he'd asked lots of questions, amazed that such a thing as a ghost could exist, could be hiding, watching them, thinking all its ghost thoughts. And Gruntle had tried to answer him, though it was obviously a struggle. And when Harlow asked him if maybe his father, who was dead, might be a ghost out there somewhere far away, his uncle had said nothing. And when he asked if maybe his ghost father was still around because he was looking for his son, then Gruntle's big hand squeezed tight and then tighter for a breath or two, not enough to actually hurt Harlow, but close. And then the grip softened once more and Gruntle took him off to buy sweets. He'd probably seen Hinter, looking out through one of the gloomy windows of the tower. He'd probably wanted to tell Hinter to go away and never come back, like bad fathers did. Because maybe Harlow's father wasn't dead at all, since one time his real mother had said something about putting the bastard away, and though Harlow didn't know the precise meaning of bastard, he'd heard it often enough to guess it was a word used for people no one liked having around. But thinking about Gruntle made him sad, so instead he reached for the jug of water again and drank deep. Bainisk watched him and then rose.
There's a new chute that's been cleared. I was thinking maybe you could climb it if you was rested up enough. Sure, Bainisk, I'm ready.
They set out in silence, but this time the silence wasn't uncomfortable, and Harlow felt such a wave of relief when he realized this that his eyes welled up for a moment. Silly, really, and dangerous besides. When he had a moment when Bainisk wasn't looking, he quickly wiped his grimy cheeks and then dried the backs of his hands on his tunic. Even had he been turned towards Harlow, Bainisk probably would not have noticed. His mind was stepping stealthily onto the worn stones of the path leading to Hinter's tower, so that he could see the ghost for himself. What a thing that would be, to see with his own eyes something that he had never seen before. There in that amazing city so far away, where all manner of wonders jostled with the crowds on all the bright streets, where ghosts argued with landlords over rent, where people had so much food they got fat and had to be carried around. And people didn't hurt other people for no good reason, and people like Venaz got exactly what they deserved. Oh yes, he did love that city, that place where he had never been.
Don't be absurd. The modestly pudgy man in the red waistcoat is not so crass as to fish for weeping multitudes in the rendition of this moment, nor so awkward with purple intent. Give Crupper some credit, you who are so quick to cast aspersions like hooks into a crowded pool. Caught something, did you? No, dear friend, do not crow your prowess. 'Twas only this carp desperate to get out. The water's reflection is not so smooth. Oh, no, not so smooth. Is Bainisk's city quaint, possibly even cute and heartwarming, in a softly tragic way? Not the point. Some of us, you see, or don't, still dream of that city where none of us has ever been. That, dear ones, is the point. Second guessing is murder, or, depending on one's point of view, suicide. Blend had found plenty of opportunity to consider such matters while lying bleeding on the floor of Carole's bar. It had been close, and without Mallet around, the prospects of a thorough healing of her wounds was something she would just have to live without. The councilman, Coll, had sent over a local cutter with passing skills in common dental, and he had managed to half-knit the ruptured flesh and stem the flow of blood, and then had taken needle and gut to suture the wounds, all of which left Blend propped up on her bed, barely able to move. Carole's bar remained closed. What had once been a temple was now a crypt. From what Picker had told her, there wasn't a patch of raw earth in the cellars below that wasn't soft and queasy underfoot. The Elder God never had it so good. Blue Pearl and Mallet, both dead. The very idea of that left gaping holes that opened out beneath every thought, every feeling that leaked through her grim control. The bastards had survived decades of war, battle after battle, only to get cut down in their retirement by a mob of assassins. The shock lingered there in the echoes of empty rooms, the silences from all the wrong places, the bitter arguments that erupted between Ansi and Picker in the office or in the corridors. If Dyker remained resident, if he hadn't fled, he was silent, witnessing, as any historian would, every opinion strapped down into immobility. And it seemed thoroughly uninterested in whether she, or any of them, lived or died. The sunlight creeping through the shutters told her it was day, possibly late afternoon, and she was hungry and maybe, just maybe, they'd all forgotten her. She'd heard the occasional thump from the main floor below, a few murmured conversations, and was contemplating finding something to pound on the floor when she heard steps approaching along the corridor. A moment later, her door opened and in strode Silara, bearing a tray. Something sweet and avid curled up deep in Blend's gut, then squirmed at a succession of delicious thoughts.
Gods, you're a sight! I was moments from slipping away, straight into Hood's hoary arms. But now, all at once, you have reason to live, yes, all that. It's taboo. I hope you don't mind. But the only cuisine I know at all is Seven Cities, and little enough of that.
They've got you cooking now?
Pays my room and board. At least,
she added as she set the tray down on Blend's lap,
no one's demanded I clear my tab.
Blend looked down at the skewers of meat and vegetables and fruit. The pungent aroma of green spice made her eyes water.
Money can go piss itself, she said.
Silara's eyes widened. Blend shrugged, reaching for the first skewer.
We were never in this to get rich, love. It was just something to do, a place to be. Besides, we're not going to hold our hands out when it comes to you and Barathol and Char. Gods below, you dragging Dyker off on a date kept the old fool alive, and Barathol and Char arrived like a mailed fist, from what I hear, just in time, too. We may be idiots, Silara, but we're loyal idiots.
I imagine, Silara said, pulling a chair close. The Assassin's Guild is not thinking of you as idiots at the moment. More like a hornet's nest they regret kicking.
Regret? She snorted. That's too mild a word. If you think you're reeling, consider the Guildmaster right now.
He'll recover, Blend said. Us? I'm not so sure. Not this time.
Silara's heavy-lidded eyes settled on Blend for a long moment, and then she said,
Picker was badly shaken. Still is, in fact. Time and again I see the color drain from her face. I see her knees go weak, and she reaches out to grab hold of something. Middle of the night, she's up and pacing the hallways.
She acts like Hood's at her shoulder these days.
That's just it, though, isn't it? A few years ago, and she'd be strapping on the armor and counting quarrels. We'd have to chain her down to keep her from charging off.
You don't get it, do you, Blend?
What?
Years ago, as you say, she was a soldier. So were you. A soldier lives with certain possibilities. Needs to keep in mind what might happen at any time. But you're all retired now. Time to put all that away. Time to finally relax.
Fine. It takes a while to get it all back.
Blend, Picker's the way she is right now because she almost lost you.
In the silence that followed that statement, Blend's mind was a whirl.
Then, she can't bear to come in here and see you the way you are, so pale, so weak.
And that's what's keeping her from hunting the killers down? That's ridiculous. Tell her from me, Silara, that all this going soft shit is unattractive. Tell her if she's not ready to start talking vengeance, then she can forget about me. We've never run from anything in our lives, and as soon as I'm back on my feet, I plan on a rat hunt the likes of which the Guild has never seen.
All right.
Is this what all the arguing's about? Her and Ansi?
A nod.
Find me a high denal healer, will you? I'll pay whatever it takes.
Fine. Now eat.
The corpse still smelled of fermented peaches. Laid out on a long table in one of the back rooms, the Segula might have been sleeping one off, and Picker expected the ghastly warrior's serenely closed eyes to flicker open at any moment. The thought sent shivers through her, and she glanced over once more at Dyker.
So, historian, you've done some thinking on this, some jawing with that bard and that alchemist friend of yours. Tell us, what in Hood's name are all these pickled Segula doing in the cellar?
Dyker frowned, rubbed at the back of his neck, and would not meet Picker's hard stare.
Baruch didn't take the news well. He seemed upset. How many casks have you examined? There's 12 of the bastards, including this one. 3 are women.
Dyker nodded.
They can choose, warriors or not. If not, they cannot be challenged. Seems to relate to infant mortality.
Picker frowned.
What does? Denol and midwifery. If most children generally survive, then mothers don't need to birth 8 or 10 of them in the hopes that 1 or 2 make it.
Well, that's the way it is everywhere.
Of course, Dyker continued as if he had not heard her statement, some cultures have an overriding need to increase their population base, and this can impose strictures on women. There's a high attrition rate among the Segula. A dueling society by its very nature cuts down the survival rate once adulthood is reached. Young warriors in their prime, probably as deadly as a war, only this is a war that never ends. Still, there must be periods, cycles perhaps, when young women are freed up to choose their own path.
Picker's eyes settled on the corpse on the table while Dyker spoke. She tried to imagine such a society, wherein, like Bedouin cows, all the women stood moaning as their tails were pushed to one side almost as soon as the latest calf had dropped out bleating onto the ground. It was madness. It was unfair.
Good thing even Segula women wear masks, she muttered.
Sorry, what?
She scowled across at the historian.
Hides all the rage.
Oh, well, I don't know that the non-warrior women do. It never occurred to me to ask. But I see your point.
But is that enough?
She asked.
Do so many warriors kill each other that it's necessary to demand that of the women?
Dyke had glanced at her, then away again.
The bastard's hiding some suspicions. I don't know, Picker. Could be. Their savagery is infamous. How long do you think these ones have been down there? In the cellar, I mean, in those casks.
The seals are Templar. Baruch suggests that the cult persisted, in some residual form, long after its presumed extinction.
Decades? Centuries?
He shrugged.
But what are they doing here in Darujistan, anyway? Those islands are right off the south end of the damned continent. Nearly 1,000 leagues between them and this city.
I don't know.
Yeah, right.
Sighing, she turned away.
Seen Ansi? At the bar. Typical. Depleting our stock.
Your indecision has left him despondent.
Stuff that, Dyker, she snapped, walking from the room, leaving him there with that damned corpse.
It was a contest which of them was the least forthcoming, in any case, and she was tired of the duck and dodge. Yet something in all of that had lodged in her the suspicion that the guild contract out on them was connected, somehow, with this old temple and all its grisly secrets.
Find the connection and maybe find the piece of shit who put the chop on us. Find him, or her, so I can shove a cusser up inside nice and deep.
Ansi was leaning on the bar, glowering at nothing in particular, at least until he found a perfect victim in Picker as she walked up.
Careful, woman, he growled. I ain't in the mood.
Ain't in the mood for what?
For anything.
Except one thing.
Anything you might try on me is what I meant. As for the other thing, well, I've already decided to go it alone if I have to.
So, she leaned on the bar beside him. What are you waiting for, then?
Blend. Once she's back on her feet, Pick, she'll be hungry enough to take the fight to him.
He tugged on his moustache, then scowled at her.
It's you I can't figure.
Ansi, Picker said, sighing. Much as I'd love to murder every damned assassin in this city, and the Guildmaster too, they're not the source of the problem. Someone hired them, only we don't know who, and we don't know why. We've been through this before. We're back right where we started, in fact, only this time we're down two.
She found she was trembling and was unable to meet Ansi's stare.
You know, I find myself wishing Ganos Paran was here. If anybody could work out what's going on, it's the captain.
Ansi grunted.
Master of the deck, aye.
He drank down the last of his drink and straightened.
Fine. Let's go to the finest house, then. Maybe he's in there, maybe he's not. Either way, it's doing something.
And leave Blend here on her own?
She's not alone. There's Dyker and Silara, not to mention that bard. There ain't nobody coming back to finish us, not in the daytime, at least. We can be back before dusk, Pick.
Still, she hesitated. Ansi stepped close.
Listen, I ain't so stupid. I know what's going on in your head. But us just sitting here is us waiting for their next move. You know the Marine doctrine, Corporal? It ain't our job to react. It's our job to hit first and make them do the reacting. Twice now they hit us. They do it again and we're finished.
Despite the alcoholic fumes drifting off the man, his blue eyes were hard and clear, and Picker knew he was right. And yet, she was afraid, and she knew he could see it, was struggling with it, badly, since fear was not something he'd expect from her.
Not ever. Gods, you've become an old woman, Pick, frail and cowering. They've killed your damned friends. They damned near killed your dearest love. I doubt he's there, she said. Else he'd have been by. He's gone somewhere, Ansi. Might never be back, and why would he? Wherever Paran's gone, he's probably busy. He's the type. Always in the middle of some damned thing.
All right, Ansi allowed. Still, maybe there's some way we can, send him a message.
Her brows rose.
Now that's an idea, Ansi. Glad one of us is thinking.
Aye. Can we go now, then?
They set out, making use of a side postern gate. Both wore cloaks, hiding armor and their swords, the weapons loose in their scabbards. Ansi also carried two sharpers, each in its own cloth sack, one knotted to his weapon harness and the other down at his belt. He could tug a grenade loose and fling it in its sack as one might throw a slingstone. It was his own invention, and he'd practiced with the stone inside the sack, acquiring passable skill. Hood knew he was no sapper, but he was learning. Nothing infuriated him more than losing a fight. True, they'd come out the other side, while pretty much all of the assassins had died, so it wasn't really a defeat, but it felt like one. Since retiring, his handful of Malazan companions had come to feel like family. Not in the way a squad did, since squads existed to fight, to kill, to wage war, and this made the tightness between the soldiers a strange one. Stained with brutality, with the extremes of behavior that made every moment of life feel like a damned miracle. No, this family wasn't like that.
They'd all calmed down some, loosened up, left the nasty shit far behind, or so they'd thought. As he and Picker set out for Cole's estate and the wretched house behind its grounds, he tried to think back to when he'd had nothing to do with this kind of life, back to when he'd been a scrawny, bow-legged runt in Fallar. Bizarrely, his own mental image of his 10-year-old face retained the damned moustache, and he was pretty sure he'd yet to grow one, but memories were messy things. Unreliable, maybe mostly lies, in fact. A scatter of images stitched together by invented shit, so that what had been in truth a time as chaotic as the present suddenly seemed like a narration, a story. The mind in the present was ever eager to narrate its own past, each one its own historian, and since when were historians reliable on anything? Aye, look at Dyker. He spun a fine tale, that one about Coltane and the chain of dogs. Heartbreaking. But then those were always the best kind, since they made a person feel, when so much of living was avoiding feeling anything. But was any of it real? Aye, Coltane got killed for real. The army got shattered, just like he said. But any of the rest? All those details? No way of ever knowing. And it don't really matter in the end, does it? Just like our own tales, who we were, what we did. The narration going on until it stops, sudden, like a caught breath that never again lets out. End of story. A child with a moustache was looking at him, there in his head, scowling, suspicious, maybe disbelieving. You think you know me, old man? Not a chance. You don't know a thing, and what you think you remember ain't got nothing to do with me, with how I'm thinking, with what I'm feeling. You're farther away than my own Da, that miserable, bitter tyrant neither of us could ever figure out. Not you, not me, not even him. Maybe he's not us, but then he's not him either. Old man, you're as lost as I am, and don't pretend no different. Lost in life, till death finds you. Well, this was why he usually avoided thinking about his own past. Better left untouched, hidden away, locked up in a trunk and dropped over the side to sink down into the depths. Problem was, he was needing to dredge up some things all over again. Thinking like a soldier, for one, finding that nasty edge again, the hard way of looking at things, the absence of hesitation. Gallons of ale wasn't helping. Just fed his despondency, his sense of feeling too old for all of it now.
"Gods below, Ansie, I can hear you grinding your teeth from over here. Whatever it is, looks like it's tasting awful."
He squinted across at her.
"Expect me to be skipping a dance down this damned street? We're in more trouble than we've ever been, Pick."
"We've faced worse."
"No, because when we faced worse, we was ready for it. We was trained to deal with it, grab it by the throat, choke the life from it."
He paused, and then spat onto the cobbles before adding, "I'm starting to realise what retirement really means. Everything we let go of, we're now scrabbling to get back, only it's out of reach. It's fucking out of reach!" She said nothing, and that told Ansie she knew he was right, that she felt the same. Scant comfort, this company. They reached Cole's estate, went round towards the back wall. The journey from Carul's bar to here was already a blur in Ansie's mind, so unimportant as to be instantly worthless. He'd not registered a single figure amidst the crowds on the streets. Had they been tracked, followed? Probably.
"Hood's breath, Pick. I wasn't checking if we picked up a sniffing dog. See what I mean?"
"We did," she replied. "Two of them. Lowlifes, not actual assassins, just their dogs, like you say. They're keeping their distance. Probably warned right off us. I doubt they'll follow us into the wood."
"No," Ansie agreed. "They'd smell ambush."
"Right, so never mind them."
She led the way into the overgrown thicket behind the estate. The uneven forest floor was littered at the edges with rubbish, but this quickly dwindled as they pushed deeper into the shadowy overgrown copse. Few people, it was obvious, wanted to set eyes on the finest house, to feel the chill of it looking right back at them. Attention from something as ghastly as that dark edifice was unwanted attention. 30 uneven strides in, they caught sight of the black half-stone, half-wood walls, the wrinkled, scarred face of the house, shutters matted like rotted wicker, no light leaking through from anywhere. Vines snaked up the sides, sprawled out over the humped ground in the low-walled yard. The few trees in that yard were twisted and leafless, roots bared like bones.
"More lumps than last time I was here," Picker observed as they made their way towards the gate.
Ansie grunted. "No shortage of idiots trying to get inside, thinking they'll find treasure."
"Secret shortcuts to power," she added. "Magical items and crap. And all they got was an early grave."
He hesitated at the gate and glanced at Picker.
"Could be we end up the same way."
"Stay on the path, that's the trick. Follow me."
He fell into step close behind her as she set out along the narrow, winding track of tilted pavestones. Too close, as he trod on her heel and almost made her stumble. She shot him a vicious look over one shoulder before continuing on. The sheer lack of anything untoward had Ansie's nerves overwrought by the time they reached the door. He watched as Picker lifted a gloved hand, made a fist, hesitated, then thumped it hard against the black wood. The boom reverberated as if an abyss waited on the other side. They waited. From here, all sounds of the city beyond this wood had vanished, as if the normal world had ceased to exist, or perhaps the endless rush of life out there held no relevance to what loomed before them now, this grotesque intrusion from another realm. A dozen heartbeats. Picker made to pound once more on the door. The clunk of a latch sounded dully through the thick wood, and a moment later the door creaked back. Paran had spoken of the Lich resident in the Finest house, the blasted creature that had once been a Jaggot, but this was Ansi's first sight of it. Tall, gods how he hated tall things, gaunt yet large-boned, adorned in a long ragged coat of black chain. Bared head with long colourless hair hanging down from patches, where the scalp was visible, there was twisted scarring, and in one place something had punctured through the skull, and within the uneven hole left behind there was only darkness, as if the apparition's brain had simply withered away. Tusks in a shattered face, the eyes shrunken back into shadows. All in all, Ansie was not inspired with confidence that this fell meeting would proceed in anything like a reasonable fashion.
"Lord Raist," Picker said, bowing. "I'm a friend of Ganos Paran. If you recall, we met..."
"I know who you are, Corporal Picker,"
the Lich replied in a deep, resonant voice.
"This is Sergeant Ansie."
"What do you want?"
"We need to find Ganos Paran."
"He is not here."
"We need to get a message to him."
"Why?"
Picker glanced at Ansie, then back up at Raist.
"Well, it's a complicated tale. Can we come inside?"
Raist's dead eyes held steady on her for a long moment, and then he asked,
"Do you expect me to serve refreshments as well?"
No, that won't be necessary, Raist."
The Jaggot stepped back. Picker edged round him and halted a few steps in. Ansie pushed in behind her. They stood in a vaulted entryway, raw black stone underfoot. Opposite the front door there were twin doors and a narrow corridor off to the right and left. The air was dry and warm, smelling of freshly turned earth, reminding Ansie of the cellar beneath Karul's bar.
"Been digging graves?" he asked, and then cursed himself, trying to ignore Picker's wild stare.
Raist shut the door and faced them.
"What manner of refreshments were you expecting, Sergeant Ansie? I am afraid I have nothing buried within the house. If you like, however..."
"No, that's fine,"
Picker said hastily. Ansie could only nod agreement. His mouth had dried up, tongue like a piece of leather gummed against the palate. And he needed to empty his bladder. But the thought of asking directions to the water closet was suddenly akin to demanding that the Jaggot hand over all his money or else. Raist studied them in silence for a moment longer and then said,
"Follow me if you must."
The Lich's moccasin-wrapped feet made rasping sounds. Cloth rustled, the mail of the coat crackling as Raist walked to the double doors and pushed them open. Within was a main room bearing a stone fireplace directly opposite, wherein flames flickered cosily, and two deep high-backed chairs to either side, sitting on a thick woven rug bearing arcane geometric patterns barely visible in the general gloom. Large tapestries covered the walls to either side, one clearly Malazan in origin, probably Untan, given the subject matter, some antiquated court event, significance long lost but no doubt relevant to House Paran. The other was local and depicted a scene from the Night of the Moon, when Moon's spawn had descended to brush the highest buildings in the city, when dragons warred in the night sky, and Raist himself had attempted his assault upon Darujistan. The image focused on the dragons, one black and silver-maned, the other muted bronze or brown. Jaws and talons were locked upon one another as they fought in mid-air, with the backdrop, the base of Moon's spawn, and the silhouettes of rooftops and spires, all bordered in an intricate pattern of great ravens in flight.
"That's not bad," Picker muttered, eyeing the work.
Ansi grunted, not one to ponder too much on artwork beyond identifying whatever scene it happened to be recording. Personally, he could not imagine a more useless talent, and thanked the gods he'd never been cursed with such creative misery. Most of his own memories of great events he had witnessed employed stick figures, and that was good enough for him. It did not occur to him that this was at all unusual. Raist gestured to the two chairs.
"Sit down," he said,
the tone only vaguely related to an invitation. When they had done so, both angling their chairs to face the jacket, he said,
"Explain to me, if you will, how precisely you intend to send Ganos Paran a message."
"We have no idea," Picker said with a queasy smile. "We were hoping you might have some suggestions."
"I have many suggestions," Raist replied, "none of which are relevant to your request."
Ansi slowly narrowed his eyes, but said nothing. Picker opened her mouth a few times, breaking off a succession of possible responses, the repeated gaping reminding Ansi of netted fish on the deck of his Dar's fisher boat. "Unless I just made that up. All a lie, maybe. Maybe I seen a fish on some other deck. How can I be sure? How can—"
"One possibility occurs to me," Raist said. "It would, I suspect, require that one of you be an adept with the deck of dragons, or possessing the potential thereof."
"I see," said Picker. "Well, I've had a few brushes with the deck."
"You are an illustrator of decks?"
"What? Oh, not that kind of brush. I mean, I've had my hands on them a few times."
"Did such contact leave you damaged, Corporal Picker?"
"Damaged how?"
"Are you perhaps now insane?"
She sat upright. "Hang on! How in Hood's name would I even know if I was insane or not?"
"Precisely," said Raist, and waited.
Ansi's gaze fixed once more on the jacket.
"Pick," he finally growled.
She twisted to face him in exasperation.
"What is it now, Ansi?"
"This bastard's having us on."
Her eyes bulged momentarily, and then she looked once more at the jacket, who shrugged.
"One needs to amuse oneself on occasion. Company is so very rare these days."
"So when it arrives," Ansi snapped, "you treat it like dirt? Do you think maybe there's a connection atwixt the two, you hoary lick?"
"Like dirt? I think not. More like with amiable contempt."
"You got a few things to learn about people, Jagat."
"Undoubtedly, Sergeant Ansi. Alas, I find myself disinclined to make any effort in that direction."
"Oh, and what direction do you make your efforts in?"
"When I discover one, I will let you know if it proves of any interest to either me or, of course, you. In the meantime, I have no idea if communication is possible with Ganos Paran. Perhaps if you informed me of your present crisis, I might be able to assist you in some way that does not involve precipitous, desperate acts that might ultimately inconvenience me. God forbid we do that, snarled Ansi. Hood is not one to forbid much of anything, Raist observed.
Can't think he much likes these Azath houses, Picker said, having recovered from her shock and irritation, and perhaps indignation. All this trapping of souls and things like you, Raist.
I doubt I rate highly on Hood's wish list, the undead Jaghut replied.
Ansi grunted a laugh. All right. I'm finally working out your sense of humor. And I thought Malazan Marines were dry, abyss below. Fine, Raist, let's play this game for real. If you can help us with our problem, we'll do something for you in return. If it's within our abilities, that is, so nothing like get me out of here or anything like that, but, you know, other stuff.
I do have a modest request. Very well, I accept the reciprocal engagement.
Ansi grinned across at Picker and then said to Raist, It's this. Someone's taken out a contract on us. We don't know why. We're thinking maybe Perrin can work out who and what's got him so aggravated. The Jaghut stared. Picker cleared her throat.
Possible causes. One, we're Malazans, veterans. We've made more than a few enemies on this continent. Two, we own Karul's Bar, which used to be Karul's Belfry, which used to be Karul's Temple. In the cellar we just found 12 pickled Segula. Maybe centuries old, but looking fresh. Since they're, pickled. She paused, drew a breath, and then continued. Three, well, I ain't got to three yet. The way I figure it, it's all got to do with Karul. Maybe some cultists want the temple back. Maybe someone put in an order for pickled Segula and wants them delivered.
Ansi stared at her.
Someone did what? Pick, that's the stupidest idea I've ever heard.
I wouldn't argue with that, she said. Only I'm desperate, and besides, I got a hunch those Segula are part of the problem.
Ansi looked to Raist. So there it is. Got any suggestions, or are you just going to stand there forever?
Yes, I am, Raist replied. But that detail is not relevant. As for suggestions, I suggest you kill every assassin in the city.
Then whoever wants us dead just starts hiring thugs, Picker said.
Kill all thugs.
Ansi tugged at his moustache. Ain't practical. There's only three of us left. It'd take years.
Kidnap the guildmaster and torture him or her to reveal the client. Then kill the client.
Killing the client makes sense to us, Picker said, nodding. The kidnapping thing doesn't sound very feasible. We'd have to carve through a few hundred assassins to do it. Besides, we don't know where the guildmaster's hideout is. We could capture and torture an assassin to find that out, but they probably operate in cells, which means whoever we get might not know a thing. The point is, we don't know who the client is. We need to find out, Raist said.
Your suspicion that the Karul Temple is central to this matter is probably accurate. Determining the specifics, however, would best be served by enlisting the assistance of the Master of the Deck.
That's what we wanted in the first place, Ansi shouted.
Extraordinary, isn't it?
Ansi glared up at the infuriating lick, bit down a few retorts that might prove unwise. He drew a deep breath to calm himself, and then said in a nice, quiet tone, So let's see if we can send him a message, shall we?
Follow me, Raist said.
Back into the corridor, turning right, 5 strides to a narrow door on the left that led into the squat round tower, up the spiral staircase, arriving into the upper level, a circular room with the walls bearing oversized painted renditions of the cards of the deck of dragons. Something twisted the eye in this chamber, and Picker almost staggered.
Gods below, muttered Ansi. This place is magic. Makes me sick to the stomach.
The images swirled, blurred, shifted in rippling waves that crossed from every conceivable direction,
a clash of convergences inviting vertigo no matter where the eye turned. Picker found herself gasping. She squeezed shut her eyes, heard Ansi cursing as he backed out of the room. Raist's dry voice drifted faintly into her head.
The flux has increased. There appears to be some manner of deterioration. Even so, Corporal Picker, if you focus your mind and concentrate on Ganos Paran, the efficacy of your will may prove sufficient to anchor in place the Master's own card, which perhaps will awaken his attention. Unless, of course, he is otherwise engaged. Should your willpower prove unequal to the task, I am afraid that what remains of your sanity will be torn away. Your mind itself will be shredded by the maelstrom, leaving you a drooling wreck.
After a moment, he added,
such a state of being may not be desirable. Of course, should you achieve it, you will not care one way or the other, which you may consider a blessing.
Well, she replied, that's just great. Give me a moment, will you?
She tugged from her memory the captain's not unpleasant face, sought to fix it before her mind's eye.
Ganos Paran, pay attention. Captain, wherever you are, this is Corporal Picker in Darujistan. Ganos, I need to talk to you.
She saw him now, framed as would a card be framed in the deck of dragons. She saw that he was wearing a uniform, that of the Malazan soldier he had once been. Was that her memory, conjuring up her last sight of him? But no, he looked older. He looked beaten down, smeared in dust, spatters of dried blood on his scarred leather jerkin. The scene behind him was one of smoke and ruination, the blasted remnants of rolling farmland, tracts defined by low stone walls, but nothing green in sight. She thought she could see bodies on that dead earth. Paran's gaze seemed to sharpen on her. She saw his mouth move, but no sound reached her.
Ganos, Captain, listen, just concentrate back on me.
Not the time, Corporal. We've landed in a mess. But listen, if you can get word to them, try. Warn them, Picker. Warn them off.
Captain, someone's after the temple. Karul's temple. Someone's trying to kill us.
Chistan can take care of itself, Pick. Baruk knows what to do. Trust him. You need to find out who wants it. Talk to Krupa. Talk to the eel. But listen, pass on my warning, please.
Pass it on to who? Who are you talking about, Captain? And what was that about Krupa?
The image shredded before her eyes, and she felt something like claws tear into her mind. Screaming, she sought to reel back, pull away. The claws sank deeper, and all at once Picker realized that there was intent, there was malice. Something had arrived, and it wanted her. Shrieking, she felt herself being dragged forward into a swirling madness, into the maw of something vast and hungry, something that wanted to feed on her. For a long, long time, until her soul was gone, devoured, until nothing of her was left. Pressure and darkness on all sides, ripping into her, she could not move. In the midst of the savage chaos, she felt and heard the arrival of a third presence, a force flowing like a beast to draw up near her. She sensed sudden attention, a cold-eyed regard, and a voice murmured close.
Not here. Not now. There were talks once that you carried. There was a debt still unpaid. Not now. Not here.
The beast pounced. Whatever had grasped hold of Picker, whatever was now feeding on her, suddenly roared in pain, in fury, and the claws tore free, slashed against its new attacker. Snarls, the air trembling to thunder as two leviathans clashed. Dwarfed, forgotten, small as an ant, Picker crawled away, leaking out her life in a crimson trail. She was weeping, shivering in the aftermath of the thing's feeding. It had been so intractable, so horribly indifferent to who she was, to her right to her own life.
My soul was food. That's all. Abyss below.
She needed to find a way out. All round her, chaos swarmed and shivered as the great forces battled on, there in her wake. She needed to tell Ansi things, important things. Krupa, Baruch, and perhaps the most important detail of all. When they'd walked into the house, she had seen that the two bodies that had been lying on the floor on her last visit were gone.
Gone. Two assassins, said Paran. And one of them was Vorkan. She's in the city. She's out there, Ansi. Concentrate! The room! In the tower! Find the room!
Crawling, weeping, lost. Ansi loosed a dozen curses when Raist dragged Picker's unconscious body onto the landing.
What did you do?
Alas, the Jackut said, stepping back as Ansi fell to his knees beside the woman.
My warnings of the risk were insufficient.
As Ansi set his hand upon Picker's brow, he hissed and snatched it back.
She's ice cold.
Yet her heart struggles on, Raist said.
Will she come back? Raist, you damned lick! Will she come back?
I don't know. She spoke for a time before the situation changed. Presumably she was speaking to Ganos Paran.
What did she say?
Questions, for the most part. I was able, however, to glean a single name. Krupa.
Ansi bared his teeth. He set his hand again upon her forehead. Slightly warmer? Possibly, or this time he'd been expecting it, making it less of a shock. Hard to tell which.
Help me get her back downstairs, he said.
Of course, and now, in return for my assistance, I will tell you what I seek from you.
He glared up at the Jackut.
You can't be serious.
This time I am, Sergeant Ansi. I wish to have a cat.
A cat? To eat?
No, as a pet. It will have to be a dead cat, of course. Now, permit me to take her legs, whilst you take her arms. Perhaps some time before the hearth will revive her.
Do you think so?
No.
This had all been his idea, and now look at what had happened.
Picker, he whispered. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
A white one, said Raist.
What?
A white cat. A dead white cat, Sergeant.
Oh, aye, Raist. One stuffed lumpy with cusses. Here, catch, you damned bastard. Shit, we're down to two now. Down to two.
Never bargain with the dead. They want what you have and will give you what they have to get it. Your life for their death. Being dead, of course, whatever life they grab hold of just ends up slipping through their bony fingers. So you both lose.
That is rather generous of you, Hinter, said Baruch. In fact, I do not recall you being so loquacious the last time we spoke.
The apparition stood within the doorframe of the tower.
The struggle I face is between my desire to close my ghostly fingers about your throat, High Alchemist, and providing whatever service I can to this fair city. It must also be noted, the return of the tyrant would also mark the end of what limited freedom I possess, for I would be quickly enslaved. And so, self-interest and altruism prove unlikely allies, yet sufficient to overwhelm my natural murderous urges.
The debate is moot, Baruch replied, interlacing his fingers and resting his hands on his stomach. Since I have no intention of coming within reach of your deadly grasp, no, I will remain here in the yard.
Just as well, Hinter replied. I haven't dusted in centuries.
There are forces in the city, Baruch said after a moment. Formidable, unpredictable forces. The threat...
Enough of that, Hinter cut in. You know very well why most of those entities are in the city, since you invited them, High Alchemist. And as for the others on the way, well, few of those will surprise you much. They are necessary. So an end to your dissembling.
Not all of what approaches is my doing, Baruch countered. Were you aware that both Lady Envy and Sister Spite are here right now? The daughters of Draconis were not invited, not by me at any rate. One is bad enough, but both. He shook his head. I fear they will leave the entire city a smouldering heap of ashes, given the chance.
So do something to ensure that does not happen,
Hinter said airily. Any suggestions on that count?
None whatsoever.
Has either one paid you a visit?
You strain my altruism, High Alchemist. Very well. Of course Lady Envy has visited, and more than once.
Does she know her sister is here?
Probably.
What does Envy want, Hinter?
What she has always wanted, High Alchemist.
Baruch hissed under his breath and glanced away. She can't have it.
Then I suggest you pay her sister a visit. She resides aboard...
I know where she is, thank you. Now, have you heard of that self-proclaimed high priest of the crippled god who's now squatting in an abandoned temple of Fener and leads a congregation growing by the day?
No, I have not. But are you surprised?
The fallen god is a most unwelcome complication.
The legacy of messing with things not yet fully understood. Of course, those precipitous sorcerers all paid with their lives, which prevented everyone else from delivering the kind of punishment they truly deserved. Such things are most frustrating, don't you think?
Baruch's gaze narrowed on the ghost in the doorway. After a moment, Hinter waved an ethereal hand.
So many legacies.
Point taken, necromancer. As you can see, however, I am not one to evade responsibility.
True, else you would have come within my reach long ago, or indeed chosen a more subtle escape, as did your fellow mages in the Cabal, the night Vulcan walked the shadows.
Baruch stared and then sighed. I have always wondered at the sudden incompetence displayed by my comrades that night. Granted, Vorkan's skills were, impressive. And then he fell silent for a moment and thought about certain matters. Hinter, has Vorkan visited you?
No. Why would she?
Baruch was suddenly chilled. She made no effort at discussing anything with me that night.
Perhaps she knew how you would respond.
As she would have for Derudan as well.
No doubt.
But the others... Hinter said nothing. Baruch felt sick inside. Matters had grown far too complicated in this city. Oh, he had known that they were walking a most narrow bridge, with the yawning abyss below whispering soft invitations of surrender. But it seemed the far end was ever dwindling, stretching away, almost lost in the mists. And every step he took seemed more tenuous than the last, as if at any moment the span beneath him might simply crumble into dust. He could understand those others in the Cabal and the sudden, perfect escape that Vulcan represented, and he recalled that flat promise in her eyes on that night long ago now. It still haunted him, the ease of her betrayal, as if the contract offered by the Malazan Empire had simply provided her with an excuse for doing something she had always wanted to do, murder every other mage in the Cabal. He might ask her why, but Vulcan was a woman who kept her own counsel. She owed him nothing, and that had not changed.
You had better go now,
Hinter said, cutting into his thoughts. He blinked. Why?
Because your silence is boring me, High Alchemist.
My apologies, Hinter, Baruch replied. One last thing, and then I will indeed leave. The risk of your enslavement is very real, and is not dependent on the actual return of the tyrant. After all, there are agents in the city even now working towards that fell resurrection. They might well decide...
And you imagine they might succeed, High Alchemist?
It is a possibility, Hinter. The ghost was silent for a time and then said,
Your solution?
I would set one of my watchers on your tower, Hinter, to voice the alarm should an attempt be made on you.
You offer to intercede on my behalf, High Alchemist?
I do.
I accept, on condition that this does not indebt me to you.
Of course.
You would rather I remain neutral, and this I understand. Better this than me as an enemy.
You were once a most formidable sorcerer.
Rubbish. I was passable and fatally careless. Still, neither of us would have me serving a most miserable cause. Send your watcher, then, but give me its name, lest I invite in the wrong servant.
Chilbase.
Oh,
said Hinter.
Him.
As he made his way back to his estate, Baruch recalled his lone meeting with Vorkan, only a few nights after her awakening. She had entered the chamber with her usual feline grace. The wounds she had borne were long healed, and she had found a new set of clothes, loose and elegant, that seemed at complete odds with her chosen profession. He had stood before the fireplace and offered her a slight bow to hide a sudden tremble along his nerves.
Vorkan.
I will not apologize, she said.
I did not ask you to.
We have a problem, Baruch,
she said, walking over to pour herself some wine, then facing him once more.
It is not a question of seeking prevention. We cannot stop what is coming. The issue is how we will position ourselves for that time.
You mean to ensure our continued survival?
A faint smile as she regarded him.
Survival is not in question. We three left in the Cabal will be needed, as we were once, as we will be again. I am speaking more of our, shall we say, level of comfort.
Anger flared within Baruch then.
Comfort? What value that when we have ceased to be free?
She snorted.
Freedom is ever the loudest postulation among the indolent. And let's face it, Baruch, we are indolent. And now suddenly we face the end to that. Tragedy!
Her gaze hardened.
I mean to remain in my privileged state.
As mistress of the Assassin's Guild? Vorkan, there will be no need for such a guild, no room for it.
Never mind the guild. I am not interested in the guild. It served a function of the city, a bureaucratic mechanism. Its days are fast dwindling in number.
Is that why you sent your daughter away?
A flicker of true annoyance in her eyes, and she looked away.
My reasons are not of your concern in that matter, High Alchemist.
Her tone added,
And it's none of your business, old man.
What role, then, Baruch asked, do you envision for yourself in this new Darujistan?
A quiet one,
she replied.
Yes. Quiet as a viper in the grass. Until such time, I imagine, as you see an opportunity.
She drained her wine and set down the goblet.
We are understood, then.
Yes, he said. I suppose we are.
Do inform Derudan.
I shall.
And she left. The recollection left a sour taste in Baruch's mouth. Was she aware of the other convergences fast closing on Darujistan? Did she even care? Well, she wasn't the only one who could be coy. One thing he had gleaned from that night of murder years ago, Vorkan had, somehow, guessed what was on its way. Even back then, she had begun her preparations, all to ensure her level of comfort. Sending her daughter away, extricating herself from the guild, and visiting her version of mercy upon the others in the Cabal. And if she'd got her way, she would now be the only one left alive. Think hard on that, Baruch, in the light of her professed intentions, her desire to position herself. Might she try again? He realized he was no longer sure she wouldn't.
This is the moment for mirrors, and surely that must be understood by now. Polished with the barest of ripples to twist the reflection, to make what one faces both familiar and subtly altered. Eyes locked, recognition unfolding, quiet horrors flowering. What looks upon you here now does not mock, denies the cogent wink, and would lead you by a dry and cool hand across the cold clay floor of the soul. People will grieve for the dead, for the living, for the loss of innocence and for the surrender of innocence, which are two entirely different things. We will grieve for choices made and not made, for the mistakes of the heart which can never be undone, for the severed nerve endings of old scars and those to come. A grey-haired man walks through the estate district. No more detailed description is necessary. The blood on his hands is only a memory, but some memories leave stains difficult to wash away. By nature, he observes. The world, its multitude of faces, its tide-tugged, swirling sea of emotions. He is a caster of nets, a trailer of hooks. He speaks in the rhythm of poetry, in the lilt of song. He understands that there are wounds in the soul that must not be touched, but there are others that warm to the caress. He understands, in other words, the necessity of the tragic theme. The soul, he knows, will, on occasion, offer no resistance to the tale that draws blood. Prise loose those old scars. They remind one what it is to grieve. They remind one what it is to live. A moment for mirrors, a moment for masks. The two ever conspire to play out the tale, again and again, my friends. Here, take my hand. He walks to an estate. The afternoon has waned. Dusk creeps closer through the day's settling dust. Each day there is a moment when the world has just passed by, leaving a sultry wake that hovers, suspended, not yet stirred by the awakening of night. The Tist Eduer worship this instant. The Tist Andi are still, motionless as they wait for darkness. The Tist Leosan have bowed their heads and turned away to grieve the sun's passing. In the homes of humans, hearth fires are stirred awake. People draw into their places of shelter and think of the night to come. Before one's eyes, solidity seems poised, moments from crumbling into dissolution. Uncertainty becomes a law, rising supreme above all others. For a bard, this time is a minor key, a stretch of frailty, a pensive interlude. Sadness drifts in the air, and his thoughts are filled with endings. Arriving at the estate, he is quickly and without comment escorted into the main house, down its central corridor and out into a high-walled garden where night flowers stream down the walls, drenched blossoms opening to drink in the gathering dusk. The masked bodyguard then leaves him, for the moment alone in the garden, and the bard stands motionless for a time, the air sweet and pungent, the sound of trickling water filling the enclosed space. He recalls the soft songs he has sung here, unaccompanied by any instrument. Songs drawn from 100 cultures, 12 worlds. His voice weaving together the fragments of shadows' arrival, drawing together the day just past and the night eager to arrive. There were secrets in music and poetry. Secrets few knew and even fewer understood. Their power often stole into a listener subtle as the memory of scent on a drawn breath, less than a whisper, yet capable of transforming the one so gifted, an instinctual ecstasy that made troubles vanish, that made all manner of grandeur possible, indeed within reach. A skilled bard, a wise bard, knew that at certain moments in the course of a cycle of day and night, the path into the soul of a listener was smooth, unobstructed, a succession of massive gates that swung open to a feather's touch. This was the most precious secret of all. Dusk, midnight, and that strange period of sudden wakefulness known as the watch. Yes, the night and its stealthy approach belonged to the heart. Hearing a footfall behind him, he turns. She stands, her long black hair shimmering, her face untouched by sun or wind, her eyes a perfect reflection of the violet blossoms adorning the walls. He can see through the white linen of her dress to the outlines of her body, roundness and curves and sweeps of aesthetic perfection,
Those forms and lines that murmured their own secret language to awaken desires in a man's soul. Every sense, he knows, is a path into the heart. Lady Envy watches him, and he is content to let her do so, as he in turn regards her. They could discuss the Segula, the dead ones in the casks, the living ones serving in this estate. They could ponder all that they sensed fast approaching. He could speak of his anger, its quiet, deadly iron that was so cold it could burn at the touch, and she would see the truth of his words in his eyes. She might drift this way and that in this modest garden, brushing fingertips along trembling petals, and speak of desires so long held that she was almost insensate to the myriad roots and tendrils they had wrought through her body and soul. And he would perhaps warn her of the dangers they presented, the risk of failure that must be faced and, indeed, accepted. And she would sigh and nod and know well he spoke with wisdom. Mocking flirtation, the jaw-dropping self-obsession, all the ways in which she amused herself when engaging with the mortals of this world, did not accompany Lady Envy to this garden. Not with this man awaiting her. Fisher Kel-Tath was not a young man, and there were times when she wondered if he was mortal at all, although she would never pry in search of truth, and he was not at all godlike with physical perfection. His gifts, if she could so crassly list them, would include his voice, his genius with the lyre, and a dozen other obscure instruments, and the mind behind the eyes that saw all, that understood far too much of what he did see, that understood, too, the significance of all that remained and would ever remain hidden. Yes, the mind behind the eyes and every faint hint he offered up to reveal something of that mind, its manner of observance, its stunning capacity for compassion that only blistering fools would call weakness. No, this was one man whom she would not mock, could not, in fact. They could have discussed many things. Instead, they stood, eyes meeting and held, and the dusk closed in with all its scents and secrets. Storm the abyss and throw down a multitude of astounded gods. The sky cracks open from day into night, and then cracks yet again, revealing the flesh of space and the blood of time. See it rent and see it spray in glistening red droplets of dying stars. The seas boil and the earth steams and melts. Lady Envy has found a lover. Poetry and desire, fulminations one and the same, and oh, this is a secret to make thugs and brainless oafs howl at the night. Has found a lover. A lover.
I dreamt I was pregnant.
Torvald paused inside the door and hesitated just a little too long before saying,
"Why, that's great."
Tisera shot him a quizzical look from where she stood at the table bearing her latest throw of pottery.
"It is?"
"Absolutely, darling. You can go through all the misery of that without its being real. I can imagine your sigh of relief when you awoke and realized it was nothing but a dream."
"Well, I certainly imagined yours, my love."
He walked in and slumped down into a chair, stretching out his legs.
"Something strange is going on," he said.
"It was just a passing madness," she said. "No need for you to fret, Tor. I mean at the estate," he rubbed at his face. "The Castellan spends all his time mixing up concoctions for diseases nobody has, and even if they did, his cures are liable to kill them first. The two compound guards do nothing but toss bones, and that's hardly something you'd think renegade Segula would do, is it? And if that's not weird enough, Scorch and Lef are actually taking their responsibilities seriously."
At that she snorted.
"No, really," Torvald insisted, "and I think I know why. They can smell it, Tis. The strangeness. The mistress went to the council and claimed her place, and there wasn't a whisper of complaint. Or so I heard from Col, and you'd think there'd be visitors now from various power blocks in the council, everyone trying to buy her alliance. But nothing, no one. Does that make sense?"
Tisera was studying her husband.
"Ignore it, Tor. All of it, Your task is simple. Keep it that way.
He glanced up at her.
I would, believe me, except that all my instincts are on fire, as if some damned white-hot dagger is hovering at my back, and not just me, but Scorch and Left, too.
He rose, began pacing.
I haven't begun supper yet, Tessera said. It'll be a while. Why don't you go to the Phoenix Inn for a tankard or two? Say hello to Cropper if you see him.
What? Oh, good idea. She watched him leave, waited for a few dozen heartbeats to ensure that he'd found no reason to change his mind, and then went to one of the small trapdoors hidden in the floor, sprang the release and reached in to draw out her deck of dragons. She sat at the table and carefully removed the deerskin cover. This was something she did rarely these days. She was sensitive enough to know that powerful forces were gathering in Darujistan, making any field she attempted fraught with risk. Yet Tessera, for all her advice to Torvald to simply ignore matters, well knew that her husband's instincts were too sharp to be summarily dismissed.